The dark corner of misery. I know a corner. It sits in the angle of any room. Sometimes a living room. Sometimes an office. Sometimes the seat of a parked pickup truck. And it has a strange property. From there, you can see everything. You can see the call that ought to be made. The project that ought to be started. The conversation that ought to be had. The future. The next step of your own evolution. Is visible for miles from that corner. And yet the one sitting there does not get up. I sat in that corner for years. They were the years of tomorrow, I'll be better. And I already told you what that sentence cost me. What I have not told you is the posture of the body in which it is pronounced. It is not said standing. It is said sitting in the dark corner. Arms crossed. Waiting for someone. A partner. A stroke of luck, God Himself, to come and do for me what was mine to do. And from there, I tell you because I lived it, we play the victim with everyone and for everything. The first thing to understand about the corner is that no one locks you inside it. The jailer is subtler. It is the ego, which twists everything and manufactures postponements with admirable productivity. That steps are missing. That studies are missing, that this is very complicated, and it's better to wait for someone who knows. The ego is a brilliant lawyer with a single client, your immobility, and it never loses a case, because the judge is also him. I know its pleadings by heart, through lack of attention to my own surroundings, even the closest. I sabotaged myself, lost my balance and my equilibrium. And instead of discovering myself as an individual in order to grow, I lingered in vices and bad behaviors. I did not seek my well-being, nor my health, much less my spiritual growth. And that is how one stops caring for the important things and the great treasures life holds: family, health, one's own development, and all the success still to come. The science of this exists. And it is harder than it looks. For half a century, it was taught that passivity is learned, that the organism, struck with no way out, learns that nothing depends on it and gives up. Seligman's famous learned helplessness. But in 2016, Mayer and Seligman revisited their own experiments with the tools of neuroscience and signed one of the most elegant retractions in modern psychology. Passivity is not learned. It is the brain's default state in the face of prolonged adversity. What is learned is control. Read that again, because it inverts 50 years of intuition. No one needs lessons to stay in the corner. The corner is the factory setting. What requires learning? New circuits. Repetition. What requires, in this book's vocabulary, habit, is getting up. And there is more. Recent psychology describes victimhood as something that can turn into identity, the tendency to interpersonal victimhood. They call it the need for your wound to be acknowledged, rumination over the offense, the moral superiority of the injured. The corner, inhabited long enough, stops being a place where you are and becomes someone you are. And that is exactly the point where this book has to intervene. Because its whole thesis says that you are what you do and repeat today. Now comes the part of the chapter that has circled me for years, and I will give it to you with the same honesty with which I verified my own sentence. There is a word spoken often from the corner, mercy, and I want to do something deliberate with it. Its true etymology is beautiful. The Latin misericordia, miser, wretched, and cor. Cordes, heart, the heart turned toward the wretched. The whole tradition backs it, and backs it well. Hebrew has hezed. The loyal covenant love that acts. And rajemim, the plural of womb, visceral compassion, of a mother's insides. The Greek of the gospel has ilios, the cry of blind Bartimaeus, and the murmur of the tax collector. Biblical mercy is not pity. It is commitment that acts and a gut that is moved. That is the true meaning, and I have not come to correct it. I have come to read it in reverse, knowingly, because the word keeps in its root a warning almost no one wants to see. Misery and mercy share blood. You can still hear it in the Latin, miseria and misericordia, the wretched one folded into the very word for the heart. And there is a way of begging for mercy that is, letter by letter, begging for misery, the misery of the one who begs so as not to act, the one who pleads with God for the scraps and the handouts, because he does not believe himself capable of accomplishing anything with him. The one who says, if only it were a pittance that God placed in my hands. And there it is. Complete. The theology of the corner. Not believing yourself deserving of something better. Not believing yourself a partner in creation. Taking refuge in misery and calling it humility. I know what you're going to answer, because I answered it to myself for years. The tax collector of Luke 18 asked for mercy and left that temple justified, while the Pharisee of merits left empty. It's true, and I don't intend to dodge it. But look closely at the scene. The tax collector was not asking for scraps. He was not negotiating his immobility. He placed himself in truth before God. I am this, without makeup. And to place oneself in truth is an act, perhaps the hardest of all. It is the very act with which all recovery begins, mine included. Misery is not in acknowledging oneself. It is in begging so as not to act. The one who asks for mercy without acting, without taking part, without making his own the matter that must be resolved, is not aligned with his own spirit nor with his achievements. He seeks outside support. Blind, uninhabited, not guarding his thoughts and much less his actions, waiting for a miracle to fall from heaven already cooked. That plea lacks everything this book defends. It lacks action. It lacks penetration. It lacks human depth. From my first pages, I spoke to you of two words that gave me back my life, intentionality and delivery. And they are exactly the ones the corner never pronounces. That is why my prayer, when I learned to pray standing up, changed its grammar. Not have mercy on my smallness, but abound in me. Work with me. Build with me. Give me the wisdom and the strength to recognize this situation and move forward. Not asking for the fish nor for the net. Asking for the steady pulse and putting my hands to work. Here I must pause for intellectual hygiene, because this critique of pleading has cousins. And you already know that in this house the kinships are declared. The New Thought Current, Ernest Holmes, Wallace Wattles, Neville Goddard, has spent a century saying that pleading affirms lack and perpetuates it. And up to that point we walk together. But this book already classified that current in the chapter on smoke, where it belongs, on the shelf of magical thinking. And I do not take it back. The difference lies in the links. They propose thought right arrow result, with nothing in between, to desire something and have it simply appear, with no alignment, no order, and no follow through. That would be magic. And magic is misery with better marketing, because it too waits sitting down. What I hold carries the full, sweated through links. You think and you do. You desire and, therefore, you build. Thought, act, habit, the whole chain of the motto, with the work inside it. Co-creation is not manifesting. It is tilling. Genesis says it without ornament. Man was placed in the garden to till it, not to beg pears from the garden from the bench. There is one more thing the corner charges, and I say it with the same care with which I gave you Sawdaid. I am convinced. And this is my vision, not medicine. I mark it for you in full, that the body falls out of alignment at the energetic level before the physical one, and that this silent misalignment is the sad future of illness. Today's science does not endorse that formulation. What it does have proven, with decades of psychoneuroimmunology and allostatic load, is its first cousin, invisible disorder precedes the visible symptom. Sustained anguish, ruminated resentment, chronic victimhood do not stay in the soul. They charge in cortisol, in blood pressure, in immunity, in sleep. Emotion knocks the body out of alignment long before the body hurts. Keep the version your skepticism allows you. Either of the two tells you the same thing. The coroner is not free, not even for the body that occupies it. And what is the way out? It is not a rescue. It is a new grammar. To inhabit. That word you already watched be born in this book, and which here shows its full face. To inhabit life is the result of good thoughts, good actions, and good habits. We embrace ourselves consciously, with love, giving ourselves the time to understand ourselves and to decide what is happening to us, and we seek to take action. We distinguish between the people who want to harm us and those who do not even pay us any attention. We quickly detect those who delay us and slow our walk. We'll speak of this at length in the chapter on the friend. And so we seek, in the intimate, through prayer or meditation, the right spaces to grow. This is not a religious book. It does have, yes, some small biases of spiritual love, and I embrace them presently, for my own growth, in order to be here for the people I love, and to whom I intend to give my time and my conscious dedication. In the end, the whole chapter fits in an image I have wanted to write for years. The one who sits in the dark corner waits for someone to turn on the light. The one who gets up understands that he is the candle, and the answer to the corner's prayer, if only it were a pittance that God placed in my hands, had been given all along, hidden in the sentence itself. What God placed there is not a pittance. It is the hands.